We used to announce when the recording started. Nobody heard an announcement, right?
No, but
That's
it says
recording.
it's recording.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a useful announcement. Okay, so we dive into a new episode. Last week, we described Parashat Vayetse almost as a bridge between Toldot the week before and this week, where Toldot, the birth of Yaakov and Esav, Yaakov is in a kind of primitive, primal state of dependency, where he is, I think it was Eli who said, a mama's boy, or he was kind of domesticated. He was an Ish Tam Yoshev Oalim who kind of dealt with homebound tasks. And by the end of Toldot, he had undergone a sort of traumatic expulsion that was necessary to save his life. His mother had told him he needed to leave. He heard his brother screaming in rage. His father, almost detached from what was unfolding, was told by Rivka, Yaakov needs to leave. He needs to go and find a wife. And Yitzhak thought, oh, okay, that's what happens. But of course, he was fleeing to escape his brother's wrath. And then we had last week, Parshat Vayetze, which we said that the name itself, Vayetze, almost intones the sense of departure that Yaakov was undergoing, not just in a geographical sense, but in a maturation, becoming an adult. He was, for the first time in his life, on his own, out on a hilltop, unsure, uncertain, unskilled, untrained, and finding his own way in the world. He finds his way to family out in the east, where he has to again learn how to build and forge a relationship. He finds affection, he builds a family, and he deals with an unfair employer. But despite the growth in the narrative we seem to be given in Yaakov's character, his engagement with the world, there is still a sense of panic in his persona. He begins the parasha fleeing in the middle of the night from Esav, and Parashat Vayetze finishes as it began. We focused last week on the fact that it begins with angels and it ends with angels, which is true. The Yaakov, despite all the turmoil, is still capable of seeing angels at the end. But the other commonality is at the beginning, he's fleeing his brother in the middle of the night. And at the end, he's fleeing his uncle in the middle of the night. He kind of literally, the words used are he steals away. We didn't give much attention last week. We were going to the fact that Rachel is described as having stolen her father's idols. And maybe next year, I guess, we'll put that under pressure. Or maybe next year we'll get up to the same place and say we were going to put it under pressure. But we'll have to at some point discuss why she stole as a verb. That's not a favorable term. And why she stole her father's idols. What interest did she have in those objects? So that was the end of last week. But not only did she steal the Tignav, it also says about Yaakov, he stole. He stole away in the middle of the night to escape his uncle. There is still a sense of panic, uncertainty, where Yaakov almost is now taking refuge in the dark. Having been given that dream at the beginning of the parasha, it seems that maybe the only way he can face his fears is in the dark, where you get a little bit of privacy and containment. And then we come to this week's parasha, and it begins in almost exactly the same way. Terrified at night. We've got night on the hilltop at the beginning of Vayetze. We've got night coming away from Haran at the end of last week's parasha, and now we have night on the verge of coming back to the land of Israel, when Yaakov has confirmed for him by a series of messengers that his brother is on the march with 400 men. And that is enough to scare him senseless. So he does the traditional preparations we're told about. And what I'd like to put under pressure this evening, which I'll abbreviate the summary of the parasha. You know, I said that before, but I hope to abbreviate the summary of the parasha and kind of look at that moment when Yaakov is terrified. I think we may have touched on it before, and look at what is the character of Yaakov's fear, and look at it through the lens of Rashi, Radak, the Abarbanel, of course, the Malbim, and also Rabbi Sacks, who for me, if you were to, you know, catch me off guard without thinking about it, there are a couple of things, a couple of insights that Rabbi Sacks made over the years. He made a number over the years. There are a couple over the years that struck me in particular, this being one of those. So we'll hopefully get a chance to look at that as well. And of course, with the wonders of technology, I can even play in his voice for you the insight that he gave, because he did record pre-COVID. He decided to record his insights and his drashot and send them out. And I have to say, there'll be an appropriate juncture to commemorate and memorialize Rabbi Sacks, but he was incredibly prescient. Many of us have played catch up over the last few months with how to use technology and harness it in an age when we have no choice. But for over a decade, every time a new technology emerges, Rabbi Sacks jumped on it as an opportunity to disseminate Jewish values, which was one of his signal achievements. So, of course, we've got those recordings. So maybe I'll play some of that for you as we go through that pasuk. So that's right at the beginning of the parsha, where Yaakov is terrified. He prepares the camp, and then in the middle of the night, he gets assaulted in the dark. By whom? Who attacks him?
Esav's angel.
Leo hit it on the nail on the head. Esav's angel. Now, what is the term used in the text to describe this figure? Does it say Malach Esav? It says V'yaavek, and they wrestled
Ish.
Ish Imo. Now, what's the usual translation of the word Ish?
Man.
And it's if I would have had more time to carve out this week, it struck me at the beginning I wanted to look into it, but you know how things happen in the week. But there is, of course, this huge storied tradition that this figure was the angel of Esav. But all it says, Yavek Ishimo, that a man wrestled with him. We're not told the name, the identity, the background, whether it is a man, in fact, as opposed to an angel. But Malach, it's not like the Torah is scared to use that terminology. A few psukim earlier, it says, Vishlach Malachim, that Esav sent messengers, angels, Malachim. Malachim appear back in Vayera. Even though it says Anashim at one point, it says Malachim went to Sodom. So angels are in the biblical vernacular. And here it says Ish, a man wrestled with him, which in many ways has given an opening in the ambiguity for lots of different readings. The traditional rabbinic reading is it was the Sar Shel Esav. It was the archangel of Esav. Which, of course, is a complicated notion. It's something we all kind of accept because we're so used to it. But what do we all have angels that kind of fight on our behalf? What does this mean? And it involves all sorts of cosmology about different nations having representatives in a celestial sphere. It involves mystical assumptions. But that's certainly the, I'd say, the probably most well-known tradition in terms of who this was he was wrestling with. There's been an allegorical suggestion that actually Yaakov was wrestling with himself. And I actually, I'm sorry to do this. I know the Malbim has this view. I actually was not familiar with this. It may shock you, but I don't know Malbim cover to cover across Tanakh. But Miriam, my wife, was preparing something for her teaching at school, and she came across a Malbim and on this particular scene, and she emailed me and said, oh, I just saw this Malbim. It looks great. Have a look. He has this reading as well, that Yaakov, in the middle of the night, he was Vivatei Yaakov Levado. He kind of stood alone, which the Malbim reads as him kind of segregating himself from the material world, V'yaavek Ishimo. But his humanity started to wage war with him. This was a kind of a moment of an internal wrestle between being a spiritualized figure and being a human being. And this is Yaakov trying to figure out whether he should live a cooped up life in an ivory tower metaphorically, or whether he should engage with the world, and there was this kind of middle ground where he wrestled. And others, Rabbi Sacks as well, in previous years, has suggested that this was the definitive moment where Yaakov gets his identity. Of course, his name is changed. He's no longer Yaakov, which is almost a passive kind of hanging on to the heels of another, where he gets the name Yisrael, the wrestler. This is where he comes into his own. And this is kind of the end of that narrative arc that began in Vayetse, where he is this internal figure who's very, very, passive is the word, but he's very malleable. His mother kind of directs him. Vayetse, he comes into his own. And this is the moment where he still wants to flee. And this reading here, there's another reading that it wasn't Sarah Shalei Sav who was kind of trying to set Yaakov up for a fall the next day. And we've seen Gladiator, Russell Crowe, Gladiator, seen that movie? Right at the end, the Caesar, whose name escapes me, maybe it's Cassius, I don't remember the name of the Caesar, who basically killed Marcus Aurelius, his father, to come on. He's going to have a huge fight in the Colosseum, this illegitimate Caesar and the Gladiator, who is a general of the army who's been put into slavery. They're going to fight. But the day before the fight, the Caesar comes to kind of greet his nemesis. And what does he do? He gives him a hug to wish him well in the fight. And what does he do?
Stabs him in the back.
Yes, literally. He stabs him in the back, but not like with a huge sword, so he's kind of dead, but just right in a place where he'll slowly kind of bleed out, which is a horrific, of course, thing to do. But that's his way of hamstringing his opponent. So when they have to fight in the Colosseum, of course, he's going to win. And I don't want to spoil the ending for you. But it is called Gladiator and not Illegitimate Caesar. You get a sense of who the hero of the movie is. But there is a sense in which the Sarashal Esav, that way of reading this is that the angel came to basically hamstring, literally, Yaakov before they go to war. But another reading suggesting that this Ish, let's clear this up. First reading, this is the angel of Esav. The second reading, and this is an internal fight with Yaakov for his own identity. The third reading is this is an unnamed figure and the identity is unimportant, which is why it's just Ish. It's just basically a filling character to resolve an issue on the part of God. And what God wants to do is to hamstring Yaakov, but not so that he loses tomorrow. Why does he want to hamstring Yaakov?
So that he can't run away.
Exactly. So that he cannot run away. This is the moment where Yaakov is on the precipice of falling back into his primitive self, where he flees. That's what he does. He runs away from his brother. He runs away from his uncle. He's terrified. It's the middle of the night. He's been through a lot last week, but we can all regress. We all go through moments of bursts of growth and regression. And this is Yaakov who says, I can't do this. And sometimes you need a little bit of help. And ironically, the help he gets is a pep talk, but it's preceded by an inhibition that he can't run away. And it seems very challenging. I mean, parents do this to some degree. I'm not actually at this stage yet, but I've got a vague memory of my own childhood. When you're training kids to ride a bike, there's a moment where you take the stabilizers off and the kids are terrified and they think they're going to fall off. And guess what? Sometimes they fall off. But if people want to transition and grow, you need to prepare for the possibility that actually a little bit of blocking your path back is what makes you go forward. So you take those stabilizers off and you refuse to put them back. And of course, in some cases, that can be stultifying, terrifying. But if it's done with sensitivity and care, it can be a propulsion forward. And here Yaakov is hamstrung by God so that he can't run away. And that he has to face his brother. He thinks, look, he's marching with 400 men. I thought I could flee, but right, I don't have a choice. So I have to kind of build up the gumption and stand up. So that's the third reading, where this Ish is kind of a filling character who serves a purpose on the part of God, not on the part of Esav. And it's actually interesting. There are a number of times in Bereishit where there is this unnamed Ish, not this same guy, but an Ish who turns up. This is the first time. When else do we have an Ish? He plays an almost pivotal role. Say again?
Yosef.
Exactly. Steve's right. It's when Yosef is sent by his father, Yaakov, to go and find his brothers. he says, where are they? He said, they're in the field. He goes to the field. They're not there. But conveniently enough, there's an ish. And the ish says, oh, they went that way. And of course, that little ish, whose name we don't know, is what led to our time as a people in Egypt. Because that's how Yosef found his brothers. That's how he ends up in the pit. That's how he ends up in Potiphar's house and in the prison and in the palace, and how we all end up down there. And that kind of unnamed anonymous figure is what directs it. I think Rabbi Soloveitchik has a reading of all of this as the ish kind of standing in for destiny. But it is this periodic appearance of the unknown figure. So we've got this moment where he wrestles through the night, gets a new name, wakes up in the morning, sets up a pillar to testify to what occurred. He names the place Peniel, the face of God, and then he prepares to meet his brother. Esav, of course, comes marching with 400 people. It turns out that's just his regular entourage. He wasn't looking for war. He just likes going for a walk with 400 people. We don't have to go into every movie we've ever seen. Anybody see the movie 300?
Yes.
Yes, it's about the Peloponnesian War between the Greeks and the Persians. And Sparta goes to fight the Greeks. And officially, to fight and go to war, the Spartan king needs permission from the oracles in the ancient Greek world. And they don't give permission. They say, you can't go and fight the Persians. And it turns out, even back then, the clergy was capable of being bribed. And the oracles were being paid off by the Persians to not let Sparta go and fight, so they wouldn't get in the way. So, but the king of Sparta can't deny the oracle. So how on earth is he going to go and fight the Persians to stop them coming and causing a problem? So anyone who saw that, what's his solution? He doesn't conscript soldiers and go to war. What does he do? He takes 300 of his best friends on a stroll. They just go for a walk. Oh, look, they're Persians here, I guess we should defend ourselves. And that's his way around it. He never officially declares war. So I guess that's incidentally connected, because Esav here is going on a walk with 400 men. They're not looking for war. He sees his brother and he runs up to him. And you can imagine in that moment, the kind of Yaakov's heart beating through his chest. His brother comes up, puts him in an embrace. He still doesn't know what to expect. What is this going to end like? And it turns out that Esav gives him a kiss and they weep. Very moving scene. And of course, there is some controversy about what actually unfolded, whether it was a kiss or alternatively a
fight.
Yes, those are not things one wants to confuse. And Esav, in the tradition of one midrash, tries to bite Yaakov on the neck. And why is he crying? Why does he cry? Because according to tradition, Yaakov's neck turned to
stone.
And that is going to hurt, right? You try to bite a piece of stone, it's going to hurt. And that's why Esav bursts into tears. And there is, the Midrash picks up not just on the, how inconceivable it seems that the kind of wrathful, enraged brother comes along and just gives a peck on the cheek. It must be he intended something more. But also in the text, for anybody who's seen the Sefer Torah, there are dots on top of the word that means then he kissed him, which the Midrash takes, or the Bala Turim and others suggest, mean like little teeth. But this was an aggressive moment. And I remember there is a Midrash that actually goes further. It doesn't just say that he tried to bite him and his neck turned to stone. Anyone remember what happened to Esav's teeth in the Midrash? Not that they didn't get hurt and he cried. Anyone remember what happens in the Midrash? That Yaakov's neck turns to stone and Esav's teeth turn into, begins with W, ends with X.
X.
Wax. You got it. There you go. His teeth turn to wax. Which is this inversion where a kind of soft material hardens and a hard material softens. And I remember sitting in my dining room / kitchen in Chicago when we first moved there 7 years ago. One of my wife's uncle was in town and he came because there was a kosher Dunkin' Donuts next door. He got some donuts. We sat at the table and it must have been this parish. And he said, I just heard this fabulous understanding of this midrash.
Uh-oh. I guess he turned to stone.
All right.
Explaining why he kissed him. And I thought, okay, keep going, keep going. I'm not there yet. I've just been told my computer, my internet is unstable. Can you hear me? No?
Now you can. Now we can.
We missed the last minute of your speaking after your uncle came.
And you're frozen again.
Your finger is up in the air right now.
Which way is the wind blowing?
That's two for two, Mark.
Thanks, Jared.
Oh, hello?
Hello.
You're back.
I'm back. Can you hear me?
Yes.
For the moment.
You missed the most amazing anecdote.
I know. Tell us about the uncle.
Oh, how far did I get before I disappeared?
He went to Dunkin' Donuts.
That's all you got? He went to Dunkin' Donuts? Well, that was the most important part. But let's move on.
But
sorry?
It was kosher.
Yes, the kosher Dunkin' Donuts. So
that's,
is that literally as far as you got?
Yes.
Oh, gosh. All right. Okay. So he sat down and he said, I've heard this fabulous reading of this Midrash. Traditionally, we see the Midrash that says that Esau's teeth turned to wax and Yaakov's neck turned to stone. We usually read that as in diametric opposition to the Pshat. The Pshat is they kissed each other, and the Midrash is they didn't kiss each other. You've misunderstood it. It can't be. It must be that Esau tried to attack his brother. You can still hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to be paranoid until we finish. I'll ask that every couple of minutes. So Miriam's uncle said, maybe what the Midrash is doing is trying to deepen the pshat, not disagree with it and say that reading it in an effective way, that they are kind of have affection and the other, this is a hostile. But the Midrash is deepening how we can understand why he's kissing him. And it suggests that Esau's teeth turned to wax is not a description of a miracle in that moment that his teeth melted. It is a condensed description of the trajectory of Esau's character over the last 20 years. The hostility in him, the brashness in him, the aggression in him had softened. His teeth had almost melted in the sense that over two decades, he had learned to let go. He had grown up. He had forgiven his brother. He'd actually assembled success in his life. His teeth had turned to wax, which of course means what happened to Yaakov over the course of 20 years. He wasn't this timid, reticent, passive, malleable figure. He, in colloquial terms, grew a backbone. His neck turned to stone over 20 years. Specifically, as we just said, that last encounter with that figure in the middle of the night kind of braced him. And the reason they could meet and show affection was precisely because Esau's teeth had softened and Yaakov's backbone had hardened, and they could meet as equals, neither one intimidated or intimidating the other. And I just thought that was, you know, there are occasional moments where Dunkin' Donuts is memorable. Most often it's not for the donuts. And on this occasion, it wasn't either. That kind of stuck with me as an interesting reading of that moment and an interesting way of interpreting that Midrash as not suggesting there was some transcendent miracle in the moment, which is of course one reading, but it is a narrative unfolding of the psyche of these two figures in that moment, that one had softened as a character over time and one had hardened over time. And though that reading of the Midrash is so striking, because not only does it invert its meaning, but it also inverts its force, because the force of the simple reading of that Midrash is sudden miraculous activity. But the alternative is that this is describing decades of time and actually empowering human beings to recognize that we can change and relationships can change. They don't have to change on a dime. We don't have to change in the second. where we think they're going to attack us until the moment comes, but we take time, and over time we evolve. So that's the two meetings. We're now in Ravi. I see the abbreviated summary is not going so well. So we get to Ravi. Esav says, you know what? Why don't we hang out together? We seem to be getting on. You stay with me. I stay with you. Fantastic. But this is part of Yaakov's new backbone. He, in a gentle way, declines. Says, no. And he does it politely. He says, we're going to slow you down. Don't worry. And Esav says, oh, don't worry. I'll leave people who can go at your speed. And Yaakov says, no, we're okay. And in that moment, not only do we see Yaakov's backbone, but we also see Esav's softening, because Esav's not an idiot, right? And he must, after a couple of attempts, understand that Yaakov is declining. And at that moment, the old Esav would have had their hairs up on his back and said, what? You don't want? And go insane. And Esav reads in that moment, you know, he doesn't want this, and he doesn't make a fuss. He says, okay, don't worry about it, brother. And he walked off. And in that moment, not just the beginning of their meeting, but the end of their meeting, their coming apart, also reflects a change in their character, where Yaakov is not a doormat. Yaakov is not scared. He doesn't feel compelled. And I have to say, there are many times in life where I feel obligated to do things, and I'm not very good at standing up on occasion and saying no if I feel like I'm going to upset somebody. And here we see Yaakov saying, transcending that weakness and saying, there are times in life where you draw a line in the sand and you can't please everybody. And it must be even harder in a moment where you haven't seen your brother for 20 years and he likes you. And you think, I've had nightmares for 20 years about this guy, and he's a friend. And then the moment comes and the test is comes. Am I going to upset him? I've just got him back in my life. Am I going to upset him? And Yaakov, again, evidencing his growth, says no. But he doesn't do it in a hard way. He just has conviction. And Esav also understands, and he walks away. And it's kind of an amazing moment. And it's also astonishing, because that is the moment that is taken to define us culturally as eternal enemies. Halacha Yadua, it is a well-known law that Esav sonet Yaakov, that Esav hates Jacob. And it's based on this meeting. And we've just explained and seen this meeting as almost the opposite, where they're not enemies. It's not written in stone. They're capable of standing up to each other, of understanding each other, and parting on good terms. And Rabbi Sacks, actually, in his, I don't have it here, I think I have it at the shul, actually, in his book, Not in God's Name, he has a chapter dedicated to this meeting and whether anti-Semitism is something written into the stars. And we're fated to spend the rest of history as victims, and there are people who are fated to be perpetrators, or is there a way we can help each other to not be enemies? And he's got a long chapter on that, describing this meeting through that lens. So they depart. Yaakov ends up in a place called Sukkot. When does it get the name Sukkot? When he gives it that name. It's not called Sukkot in advance. He arrives. He calls the place Sukkot. Why does he call it Sukkot? Because he went to eat outside and it started raining? No, because he built booths for his animals. I think I spoke about this a little bit over Sukkot, in terms of Sukkot first getting their name as animal booths. He then moves to Shechem, and we have an...
Frozen. This is the part of summary he skips.
Abbreviated version.
Yeah, Shechem, Dina, you know, we skip that story. We don't teach it to the kids.
Heard it before. Best part of revenge for next Monday.
Hello, I'm back.
Welcome back.
Yaakov just left Shechem.
Say that again.
Yaakov just went to Shechem.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Wow, that I was really doing a lot of talking. I'm so sorry. I said a whole other anecdote, but this time it's about Krispy Kreme. we'll have to get them all then. Okay.
Did your uncle come then also?
Yaakov, did you hear about Dina?
No.
Oh, right.
But at school anyway.
Neither do our children.
Excellent. Okay. So he gets to Shechem. There's a whole rampage, Shimon and Levi.
Uh-oh.
It's not his night.
Nope.
Must be the Parsha.
Anybody want to take over?
We need videotape replay.
So they go to Shechem.
They took an Uber.
And fast forward. Marry her. Fast forward.
And they say, okay, you all have to have a bris milah. They say, okay, we'll have a bris milah.
We'll do it for you.
Shimon and Levi come, slaughter all the men. Yaakov gets mad at them. Anybody else want to pick up where I left off?
Mark, are you doing a proba?
Never. Just trying to fill the dead space.
I think the rabbi went to either Dunkin' Donuts or Krispy Kreme to get something.
Only.
Welcome back.
My computer, I'm on my phone now. The internet just died in the house. I don't know what that was. I'm not going to be able to share my screen with you, so you'll have to forgive me for that. But it looks like we weren't getting there anyway.
Are you at a wedding?
Next time. So we got up to Krispy Kreme's. We got up to Shechem, which is where Krispy Kreme's were invented. Yaakov sets up tent on the outskirts of the city. We have the rampage of Shimon and Levi, which I noted briefly on Monday evening in our discussion of revenge. And we could dedicate, of course, 3 weeks to a discussion just of what they're doing and how it's read, whether it was justified or not. Yaakov responds with profound anger to their behavior. But even that anger is analyzed and taken apart, because his words in expressing that anger are not about the act itself, it seems. He says, I'm enraged. Say again?
It's about his reputation.
Yeah. He says, I'm just astonished by your behavior, because now everybody's going to hate us, as opposed to saying, how on earth could you slaughter a city of people who are unarmed, essentially, and unwell? So that's worthy of a discussion itself. How could they do it? And it's not something Yaakov forgets. On his final moments, he brings it up again. I don't know if the word curse would be appropriate, but he certainly invokes this moment in his final words to Shimon and Levi. Now there is a midrash about Dina's treatment, which has plagued me. I don't know, plagued me. It hasn't kept me up at night, but when I think about it, I'm still perplexed. And I kind of, I'll share it with you, with the possibility that maybe some of you have a good thought about it if you ruminate on it, where Dina, we have the tradition, was assaulted, abused, taken against her will, and sexually assaulted. And there is a midrash that suggests, in what on its surface seems horrifying, that the verbs used in that discussion, where Shechem, we're told, was in using the words dveka, he kind of he clung to her, chafetza, he desired her, Chasheka, he lusted after her. Those verbs in that context, Midrash says, those same verbs are used in the context of how we should relate to God. Atem hadveikim l'Hashem kolchem. We should cleave to God. The word chafetz, the word chashek, is used in different verses describing our theology, how we relate to God through cleaving God and loving God and speaking to God and pining for God. And the Midrash says, and where do we learn this all from? We learn it from Shechem, who those same verbs are used in this moment. About 10 years ago, when I was a rabbinic intern, I suggested that maybe what the Midrash is doing is trying to, in the same way there is a tradition that those who have a bloodlust have a choice in life. They can become murderers, or they can become a moel or a shochet. They can channel that inner energy, which is directed by their inclination, by their nature, or by nurture toward gore or blood, and they can become a villain, or they can use that same energy, that same inclination to do mitzvot, to be a mohel, or to be a shochet. I thought maybe what's being suggested here, that cleaving in an inconceivably intense way is not in and of itself a vice. It is a vice when it is non-consensual with another human being, but to cleave in an inseparable, irrational, visceral way to God is a virtue. And perhaps what that Midrash is suggesting is that our interaction with human beings need to be measured and distant and remote. But that doesn't mean we should live a distant, remote, measured theology. We need to wrestle with God. We need to engage with God. We need to embrace God. We need to cleave to God. While a number of people were kind of moved by that, you can never tell when it's because of the accent or not, but a couple of people said, I'm a bit uncomfortable with that. And the truth is, I'm a little uncomfortable with that solution as well. So I'll leave that with you to think about. We have 5 minutes left. And I said I would. There's more that unfolds in the parsha, more of consequence as well. So, but what we'll do is return to that moment at the beginning of the parsha. We're put under pressure for the last few minutes. You can still hear me?
Yes.
Great. So I can't share my screen, although I could show you my screen, but that seems like a strange way to do it. At the beginning of the parsha, when that terror is described, the pasuk says, "V'yira Yaakov ma'od v'yetzer lo." Yaakov was v'yari ma'od. He was very afraid. V'yetzer lo, and he was distressed. And it's not just the Malbim, it's rabbinic tradition that the biblical text is incredibly concise. It does not use words that have no purpose. It doesn't use rhetoric or oratory for the sake of poetic pleasure. It tries to condense information. So why are we being told, V'yira, he was very afraid and he was distressed? It seems redundant. It seems repetitive. What's the solution? So there are a couple of lenses to this. The Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, suggests that the premise I just noted is not true. Says it's true when the rabbis are doing a drasha, they try to put pressure, as we say, parasha under pressure, they try to put pressure on the text to draw meaning out of every word. The Radak says we don't do that in pshat. In pshat, it's normal. In his words, kefel ha'inyan b'milot shonot, the matter is repeated in different words. It is repetitive. Why? Lerov yirato, because he was terrified. And to say he was scared does not do justice to his mental state. Yaakov was petrified to the core. So the only way to communicate that is v'yira Yaakov ma'od v'yetzer. He was very, 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 very afraid. That's what the Radak suggests. That double notion is about. I will note the Malbim here, who has a very different reading, because he insists there is no repetition. He says that actually, the Yira Yaakov Ma'od, Yaakov was very afraid, is distinct from V'yetzer lo. This was an unfolding chronology. He was very afraid, V'yetzer lo, and then he was distressed. And the Malbim actually suggests his distress. Why was he afraid and distressed? What was he scared of?
that they would take out their anger on him.
Who would?
The people in Shechem.
Oh, so yeah, I've jumped back a little bit. I'm sorry.
Esav
was going to kill them all.
Esav.
So we're back all the way at the beginning of the parasha when Yaakov is in the middle of the night. He hears his brothers coming, and he is terrified that Esav's about to meet him. So the Radak says the reason we're told twice, V'yira V'yetzer, that he was scared and he was distressed because he was very, very scared. But the Malbim's going to suggest they're two distinct things. Usually we understand he was afraid because he thought Esav was going to kill him. That's what he was scared of. And that's what the Radak says. He was scared they were going to kill him, but he was very, very scared. The Malbim suggests that's not true. V'yira Yaakov Mod, he was very scared. Yes, that's where he's scared of Esav. But if Yaakov was a true believer, that when God makes promises, he keeps to them, should Yaakov be scared?
No.
No, God had promised him he would protect him. God promised him on that hilltop at the beginning of last week in his dream and after that he would be there for him. And here he's scared. And the Malbim says that's why he became distressed. The year of Yaakov, and he was very afraid, insert parentheses, and because of that fear, Yaakov became distressed because suddenly he, in a self-reflective way, realized he wasn't as firm as his faith as he thought. He thought, God makes me a promise, I've got it. And the year, and then he hears Esau's coming and he feels terror and he thinks to himself, oh my gosh, I'm scared. And I'm now concerned that fear means that I don't deserve the kind of protection that a full-hearted faith would warrant. And that kind of self-reflective moment, of course, happens to many of us. We think we're confident about something, whatever it may be, and then the moment comes and we get clammed up or we get worried or concerned. And we reflect, why am I scared about this? What is terrifying me? And Yaakov, and then we begin to self-doubt. Maybe the fact that I'm scared, I'm not adequately prepared. Maybe I'm not ready for this. Maybe I can't do this. And Yaakov goes through that same self-reflection for the Malbim. And that, in many ways, serves his purpose for those who were at the afternoon Shabbat talks about Malbim's moral, which picks up on what we said about him on Zoom after Pesach, is that Malbim is a keen anti-romantic, meaning he doesn't want us to valorize or celebrate human emotion. He wants us to be calm, committed, collected servants of God. So what the Malbim does here in one fell swoop is solve two problems with the text. Number one, he solves the redundancy issue. He says there's no redundancy. There are two distinct issues here. He's afraid of Esav and he's distressed because he was afraid. Those are two separate things. And in addition to solving the redundancy, he manages to give a comment on the emotional state of Yaakov. Yaakov is afraid, which for the romantics is great. Obviously not because we celebrate his fear, but because giving emotional depth to a character is what brings them to life, makes them dramatic and compelling. And at that moment, Malbim says, that's what distressed him. The Torah is saying that is not how we should live as emotionally compelling figures. We should be full of conviction, conduct our business, follow our mission, and not be playing around with the depth of emotion that can lead us in all sorts of unpredictable ways. So that's the Malbim. There are the Abarbanel we're not going to go into because it's 901, but the Abarbanel has a radically different reading in which, if you look at the Abarbanel on the Parsha, he quotes Aristotle to suggest that actually the fear in this moment is not a signal of Yaakov's lack of faith. It actually marks him as more heroic. And this is where the Malbim and the Abarbanel are at complete loggerheads. Of course, the Abarbanel being 300 years earlier. The Abarbanel saying that the fear that Yaakov has in going to face its potential end precisely marks him as a hero, because he says, if he wasn't afraid, what kind of heroics would that be? If his life isn't meaningful to him, if he's not worried to let go of it, that's not heroic. And he quotes Aristotle, who makes the same point about defining virtue and heroism and charity. And Aristotle says, the philanthropist, the charitable figure is defined as such when they care about their money. This is what the Aristotle says. If somebody say again. I missed that. Yes, Aristotle says that if a person doesn't care about money and they give a lot of it away. Okay, I mean, it's a wonderful thing to do, to give charity, but it doesn't quite mark you as a charitable figure because you haven't sacrificed, because you don't care about money. But if you recognize the value in wealth and it means something to you and you feel pain giving that money away, we might instinctively think, well, that's bad because that means I care about money and I shouldn't care about money. But Aristotle and Abarbanel here, they know that marks you as more charitable because you are giving something up in real terms. And that's why Yaakov's fear here is a mark of his heroism, because he cares about life. And yet he's willing to go to fight. And again, that's kind of the combination of who he is. It's 9:03, so we'll wrap up very, very quickly here. Rashi says, and I think Mark may have referenced this earlier, that Rashi, citing Midrash, agrees with the Malbim that these two terms, the fear and the distress, refer to two separate things. Not one, as the Radak has it, but two separate things. He was scared because he thought he might die. And why is he distressed, Mark? If you're still with us and you didn't go tomorrow.
He was afraid to kill.
Yes. He was scared that he would die, and he was distressed that he might have to kill. And this is the traditional moment where people quote Golda Meir's famous remark. Anyone know what I'm referring to?
Yeah, we can forgive the Arabs for killing our children, but we cannot forgive them for our children killing their children, or something like that.
Exactly. Something like that. She's quoted as having said, you know, please God, someday we will forgive the Arabs for killing our children, but we can never forgive them for making us kill their children. And I know some people are not a fan of that sentiment, but here that seems to be what Rashi, read by Rabbi Sacks, takes this moment to be, where Yaakov stands there and he's terrified he might die, but he's also incredibly distressed that he may have to kill. And this is the first moment that he confronts that possibility. And in many ways, being powerless, being impotent on the world stage is a luxury, because you are spared the moral conundrums that comes with power. And once you have power, you have all sorts of gifts, liberties, freedoms, pride, but you have the illuxury of having to make decisions that can skirt morality and lead you to places that distress us. And in many ways, what we as a people went through in 1948 till now, which is we finally have an army, we finally can protect ourselves. What a gift. We're no longer victims all the time. We can stand up and fight. But with that power doesn't just come responsibility, as Spider-Man or Voltaire has it, but with power also comes complexity, because now I've got power, I can do harm, and I need to try to navigate the moral decisions of how to dispense that power. And for 2,000 years, we never had to make that choice because we didn't have power. And of course, it was horrific conditions of persecution and exile and expulsion, but we got, over those 2,000 years, along with the blood and the death and the horror, we got the moral superiority on every day because we were never harming. But then we come to 1948, we get power. And since 1948 to today, there are days when we have made mistakes, because that's the nature of having power. You can do harm without intending it, all because it's necessary. And that's what Golda Meir's sentiment was we can forgive you for harming us because we're in a moral position where we feel superior, but you turned us into killers and we don't know how to forgive you for that. And Rabbi Sacks is precisely, he reads this moment at odds with a number of other commentaries on Rashi who don't go this route. The Siftei Chachamim has two other views to how to view that distinction, that why is Yaakov distressed at having to kill his brother? I see it's 9:07, forgive me. I'm making up for Krispy Kremes and Dunkin' Donuts and outages. So The Siftei Chachamim says, why is Yaakov distressed at having to kill Esav? One view is he's distressed because he knows Yitzchak likes Esav, and he doesn't want to kill someone and upset his father. That's one view. The second view he offers is he's not worried about killing Esav. He's worried about collateral damage. Maybe somebody else will die in the confusion of war. But Rabbi Sacks suggests you don't have to go down these routes. What Yaakov is thinking about, is this going to upset my father? Am I going to kill somebody else by accident? Maybe Yaakov is just distressed that he might have to kill his brother. Even if he's permitted to, even if it's mandated to defend yourself and your family, he doesn't want to have to kill, even if he can, even if he should. And I'll read you the words of Rabbi Sacks, because I think it won't come through if I play it on my computer. Rabbi Sacks says, Jacob, father of the Jewish people, experienced not only the physical fear of defeat, but the moral distress of victory. And only those who are capable of feeling both can defend their bodies without endangering their souls. That's how Rabbi Sacks reads that moment where Yaakov is both afraid and distressed, which is, again, for me, one of the signal insights that the Rabbi Sacks has. And a unique voice for that, where he finds a way to weave modern sensibilities into our traditional ancient texts in a way that brings them to life in a new way. Please God, we'll over the course of the coming months, we'll find other opportunities to share Rabbi Sacks's thought. It actually occurred to me maybe one of the next series we do could be dedicated to a particular angle on the thought of Rabbi Sacks, and we could do maybe a series on that. I just sort of throw that out there to test the waters and see if anybody thinks that's a good idea. And we'll go from there. In the meantime, I will, if it's still recording, I will stop the recording.